Welcome, welcome, welcome back to another episode of 10,000 Adventures. I am your host, Matthew Holthouse. Thank you for tuning in and hanging out with us. If this is your first time tuning into one of our episodes, go over to Instagram and give us a follow at 10,000 Adventures Podcast so you can stay up to date with everything we have going on. And then give us a subscribe or follow on whatever platform you are listening to. So whenever we do drop a new episode, you get that notification and you can check it out. But before we get too far into things today, very special day. It is my co-host, Max Kauger's 30th birthday. Happy 30th birthday, young man.
You didn't have to say 30th twice. It's okay. I'm welcoming the 30s now at this point, but I was dreading it for the last year or so, but appreciate it.
Do you feel older and wiser, or do you still feel nice and youthful and full of energy?
I feel like I still feel pretty youthful, and I don't know about the energy part. Like everybody, it's day to day, but I'm still feeling pretty good.
I'll get you some supplements for after the show okay. To help you with the energy bit.
Sure, yeah.
No, I'm just seasoned. Well, happy birthday. Hope you had a good Easter. Hope you have a good time celebrating. I think by the time you hit 30, you probably don't do too much on your birthdays. They're not too crazy anymore.
I don't know. You tell me. It's my first time.
After 30, they're kind of downhill, man. I would say that probably after 25, you start dreading your birthday and you start dreading the happy birthday messages.
I don't dread the happy birthday messages. I dread like just being adding one more number to that age total that you're, you know, like you said, after 25, it feels like they're not as significant of an age and just creeping closer to that next decade. You know, now I'm looking at 40 in 10 years. Not that that's close, but I feel like that's like the dreading aspect of getting into your 30s and aging through mid 30s to your 40s. That's my early on thoughts about it, but appreciate you bringing it up. We're going to go and have a beer tonight and celebrate. So
do you feel any societal expectations? That's the only thing I think about on my birthday. Maybe it's creeping in on midlife crises, but you have your birthday, then you sit there and you think like, okay, I'm this old. Society thinks I should have accomplished these things by now, or I should be doing this certain point of my life. Do you ever feel any of those things or not really?
The only thing I'll mention is like, and you're in this boat too, is like we're seeing some of our friends, a lot of our friends getting married, having kids, and we're not to those milestones yet. So if you want to call those like society's expectations for hitting 30, yeah. But like this day and age, it's not, I don't think, like that unusual. I mean, I think the numbers will tell you like getting married at older ages now, and our parents were, you know, getting married in their early 20s, and now it's like not a shock if you're not getting married till 30s. You know, people are settling down and having kids when our grandparents were like right out of high school. Like that's like pretty rare now. So I understand that. And that's the only thing that popped into my mind when you bring that up. Other than that, we're doing okay.
Yeah. And the other thing too is people are living longer now, and they're living healthier and in their quote prime longer into life now. You know, think about it. When we were kids, when we were 10, if you were 60, that was like old. Now, and then when I was in my 20s, I thought like 70 was old. Now I'm kind of to the point where I'm thinking like once you hit 80, then you might start to have a decline in terms of your mental capacity and your physical ability and your ability to have a good, full, energetic day. Though that number is getting pushed further and further as we kind of advance here. So that pushes all of those things out. Your age that you get married, the age you can have kids, the age you can retire, or how long you can work and still be optimizing at your work. All of that's getting pushed. I don't mind working. So I think if I'm definitely in that bucket where once you retire, you decline very rapidly because you kind of lose your purpose on a daily basis, I would definitely be in that bucket. So working's really good for me. I don't really ever plan to retire until I'm maybe like forced to or something.
Sure. Well, that's good. It's funny. I saw, this was like a week ago. I can't remember on what social media app, but there's a little clip about like how people used to buy homes for like $10,000 and like what percentage of like their salary or how many months do they need to save up to be able to buy it. And like nowadays, like these homes that are like maybe to somebody that's not in the industry, like this home looks like it might be kind of cheap and now they're going for like $500,000. Like that part is what I think of when you're like retirement age is going to be pushed out. But I guess the positive side is maybe it's being pushed out because of things you're mentioning that we would like to think living healthier lifestyles, but I don't know.
And it's so much easier to spend money now than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Oh, yeah. Everything's just at the touch of your finger. You can spend money. There's so much more things to spend money on. So it's a lot harder to save on top of the cost of living. It's how easy it is to spend and how more disciplined you have to be nowadays to save any money whatsoever.
Yeah, there's some dark statistics you could really get in the weeds on that kind of stuff, but we'll think positivity today.
Okay, good. Well, happy birthday, man.
Appreciate it.
I know we got a pretty lengthy interview with Eric Glosson to get us ready for the Boundary Waters season coming up, but a couple of tidbits before we cut over to that I wanted to keep in the loop on. Following the rideshare story of rideshares leaving Minneapolis starting May 1st, as we're recording this, that is still the plan. A couple minor updates to follow up on from last time. So Uber's leaving the metro area altogether. Lyft is planning on leaving just Minneapolis. And then the ordinance, the new pay stuff that's going into effect, is in effect for any ride that goes through the city. So it doesn't have to start or end in the city, but any time the route drives through the city, you have to pay the driver that pay. So Uber's just decided to leave. Lyft has decided to leave Minneapolis. I don't know if that means, you know, if you're in St. Louis Park and you want to go to Woodbury, does that mean Uber's going to route you around this, or Lyft will route you around the city of Minneapolis so they don't have to pay that rate for the through traffic? Or will they still drive you through? They'll pay it for that portion, but they won't do rides that start or end in Minneapolis. Those are things that are still to come on it. So I wanted to get that update out there. The Minneapolis City Council meets on April 11th. I believe that this topic is on for them to review again. I don't know if that means they're going to revise it, change it, add to it, get rid of it completely, but that's when they're going to meet next. That's when we'll probably get a next major update on this topic. So look out for that. April 11th, the city council meets. Last thing on that, they're trying to create a ride share co-op amongst all the Uber and Lyft drivers currently here. They have them in a couple other cities. And so they're trying to come up with that. I would believe you would just sign up for it like you did Uber and Lyft if you wanted to try using that. I'm a little nervous of how that's going to work because the Uber or the drivers have much more control. So they're going to get to set how much that ride is. So they're going to get to dictate all of the terms of how much the end consumer is paying. I'm a little worried that means rides are going to be insanely expensive for the most part, especially like it's a co-op. So all of the drivers can talk to each other and so they can set their own pricing. So we'll see what ends up happening with that. That was what was a great thing about Lyft and Uber, was they got to control the pricing a little more. So the end consumers, our rides were cheaper than they were at other times. Well, at least when they're not being surcharged. We'll see how this co-op shakes out. The drivers will definitely make a lot more money. We'll see if us as end consumers are going to have to pony up and be paying a lot more for our rides. So that is the latest on it. We'll continue to follow that story. Did that all make sense? Or did I rifle that off too quick?
No. I think you fleshed it out pretty well. I mean, seems like it's got a long ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
Especially this whole, like, we're going to re-review, you know, in not too long from now. So we'll see what happens there. Like you said, I think it was a good way of putting it. It's like a game of chicken at this point. And so I'm sure, like, Uber's watching it too.
Yeah. And talking to a few people about it, they've made some really good points. Uber and Lyft have to do this. They have to leave because they can't let the city set this precedent and then they bow to that, because that opens the door for every other major metropolitan area to try to do something similar. So this market, as Minneapolis is a decent sized market, but that's a drop in an ocean of how much business they're doing. And so they would rather cut their losses here than let the city set that precedence and dictate how much the drivers are going to make, with the fear that other major metro areas will follow if this goes through. So it's a game of chicken. We'll see who ends up swerving first. But it is, I mean, there's a lot of ways to go, but it's coming quick. It's only, you know, at this point, less than a month-ish until this would go into effect and this would actually happen. So we'll see. More to come. We'll keep tracking it. A couple other quick hitter stories before we go over to our interview. March Madness. I'm sure, I don't know if you do a bracket. My bracket is absolutely completely smashed. But Minnesota State, formerly known as Mankato, they won both the men's and women's Division II basketball national championships. So that's kind of crazy. And the men's was a buzzer beater, walk-off buzzer beater to win it. So shout out to Mankato. That's really cool. They won both the men's and women national championships in the same season. Did you see that?
I saw it, and I was like, I'm not a huge basketball person, but it kind of shocked me because, I don't know, I just feel like if they're that good, you kind of hear a little bit of buzz about, like, Mankato's got a really good basketball program. Like, I've never heard that in my life. And maybe it's just because I'm not paying attention to that type of stuff. But they must. I mean, they just won two titles. So that's great. And I know, like, Minnesota's, like, been pretty consistent producer of good basketball players. So I'm like, I wonder, like, if there are a lot of Minnesotans that are on these teams. I assume so. So that's awesome. Good for them.
I had no idea either. I don't know if they're a powerhouse. Was a
I had to like double take. I'm like, wait, what? Like,
yeah.
They're good at basketball?
Yeah.
Like, not just good, but the best in Division II. I was like, whoa. Wow. All right.
Yeah. Good for them.
Congrats.
I saw the boys, at least, were the one seed, the overall one seed. So they were probably having a pretty good year, and they had won their last 17 games in a row or something. So they must be some juggernauts. I think the women's were still a great team, but not like the favorite to win it all. And they came out and just dominated. So I thought that was a really cool tidbit local sports story.
Yeah.
One of the few times it's been done in Division II or Division I. Coincidentally, UConn, who's the favorite to win the men's, and they won it last year. UConn men's and women's.
Wasn't that long ago, was
it? Have done
it
twice. In 03, I think they did it. And then, yeah, in 2014, I think they did it as well. Remember, the UConn's girls team had that absolute juggernaut where they didn't lose a game for four seasons or something insane.
And they might make it to the championship again this year, right? I think they're still alive.
The girls?
Yeah.
That I don't know.
I think I over just scrolling through some of that type of stuff, I thought I saw they're a 3 seed and they're like in the Elite Eight or They might have lost since I saw that, but I know men's, they're the heavy favorite. Take that one. So could be a Division One men's and women's possibility as well.
Yeah, while they are still alive, it could still happen. They play USC on April 1st.
Today.
Yeah, they're a 3 seed and they play the 1 seed. Speaking of that, too, Caitlin Clark has her revenge game.
Yep.
The Iowa Hawkeyes play the LSU Tigers. What's that girl? What's the girl's name on LSU that she had all the beef with? Angel? Her name's Angel. I think it's Angel Reese.
Okay.
So that'll be an exciting one. We'll have to give a follow-up on that next time.
Yeah, but there's been a lot of sports going on lately with the men's D1 hockey tournament going on right now and the basketball tournaments. We got baseball, MLB opening day just was last week, and I guess like hockey, you know, we're not really paying attention because the Wild are I think all but dead in terms of making the playoffs at this point, but that's still, you know, coming on right now and wrapping up regular season. So, and then NBA, we got Timberwolves, I think, have been playing pretty well, I think, lately. So it's like, you want to watch a sporting event lately, it's like, pick your poison. It's pretty nice.
It's that time of year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basketball and hockey playoffs will be starting. The Timberwolves are right there for the 1 seed. I think they lost to Chicago, so they've dropped out of the 1 seed, but they're like a half a game back now, so they're right there. Wild won't make it. Twins won their opening series against the Royals, so they're 2-1. Royce Lewis got hurt on opening day. I feel terrible for that guy. He's just battling injuries. But those are all storylines we'll continue watching in the coming weeks.
Frozen Four, sadly, no Minnesota teams participated in this year, but that'll be in St. Paul this year. It was a big deal to host that again, and, you know, at the beginning, everyone's hoping that their Minnesota local team's going to have a hometown Frozen Four, but unfortunately, Boston University and College are going to be the heavyweights this year, and then you got Denver and Michigan coming to St. Paul in like a little less than 2 weeks. So I bet ticket prices are dropping now that that happened. I know I looked at them before the Gophers lost this last week, and they're pretty spendy. But the demand, I think, is going to go way down, sadly, now that the Gophers aren't in it. And I think North Dakota would have been a good team to have in that Frozen Four, too, if you just were looking to get, you know, a good amount of fans into the X. So we'll see, but might be able to see some good hockey for relatively cheap, and maybe even watch a team win the national championship. So,
yeah, slightly embarrassing that there's no Minnesota teams in it when we do all this talk about how we're this great, huge hockey powerhouse. And I think the Gophers were the only Minnesota team that was in the Elite Eight, even. If they call it the Elite Eight.
They were the only Minnesota team in the entire NCAA tournament.
Yeah.
And that was like
16
teams, I think. So there's been years where we're kind of stacked in terms of Minnesota representation in that tournament. This year was a down year. You know, no Duluth, no Mankato, and you know, St. Cloud, all those schools. So yeah, it's gonna be. We'll watch anyways, and it'll be probably. I mean, it's been very close, entertaining games so far. So it should be some good hockey.
Yeah, good storyline to follow. I wonder if part of that is all of these other schools are getting Division One programs, and that's taking from some of the local talent pool. I know a lot of kids like to stay local though. But yeah, so good storyline to follow.
Great example is the Gophers played Omaha opening round.
Yeah.
And they had like 7 Minnesota kids.
Yeah.
Not to say that those kids would have like been the difference maker on the Gophers, but as far as college hockey players, like, we're by far and away the highest percentage of the state representation. So it's always been like that, and it's going to stay like that. But you could have a point there, and like, it just added St. Thomas. Like, there's probably going to be a couple good players that end up choosing to go there. and not, you know, a Mankato, a St. Cloud, a UMD, Bemidji, or University of Minnesota. So it's just sometimes it takes just one more player to make a difference.
I real quick before we go to that interview, one of my buddies is a diehard Gopher hockey fan, and every year he's just blowing up our group chat about how this is their year, mm-hmm. and they finally have the horses to get it done. And like, of course, last year was the year, this year was the year. And then he's like, well, next year they're going to have a down year, but then apparently they signed some kid last weekend, and they're like, okay, now they're back. This is their year. Next year they're gonna make another great run at it, and it's just funny to watch them fall flat on their face. I feel bad. I don't really care about college hockey too much. I do feel bad for them. I think we looked it up. So the Gophers last won a national championship in the 03-04 season, so it's literally been 20 years, mm-hmm. and I think they have 5 times in the last 20 years where they finished second. So they were the runner-up for the national championship. Most recent one last year, they lost the national championship. And literally the next day, five of their players were playing in the NHL. They had an unreal team, and they just choked this time of year. It's kind of insane.
It is. There's some good programs out there. Quinnipiac coming out of nowhere, and they might be a powerhouse for years to come. They lost this year, but yeah. That's another sad year for us Gopher fans, but carry on.
Like all Minnesota sports, we'll continue to carry on. But okay, with that, let's send it over to our interview with Eric Lawson and get us ready for some early season trips to the Boundary Waters.
Okay, and then today on the podcast, we are joined by Eric Lawson. He is an avid outdoorsman living in Ely, Minnesota, just outside of the Boundary Water canoe area. He lives in Breezy Outdoors. You can check him out at his YouTube channel, Farwater, or on his website, chasingfarwater.com. He's here to give us his experience with the Boundary Waters canoe area and to chat with us about early season trips into the BWCA. Eric, thank you so much for being here. How is the weather and the aftermath of the snowstorm up in Ely, Minnesota?
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. Our snowstorm is not done yet. It lasted a full 4 days, and it is still going strong. I think we got somewhere between 2 and 4 additional inches today. It was blowing snow really hard in the middle of the day. We might have got more than that. But yeah, I think that pushes our snow total to at least a foot, if not closer to that 13 to 14 inch range. So we're still going strong here on March 27th with our biggest snowstorm of the year.
Wow. Yeah. Here in the metro area, it was sunny and about 20 degrees today. We actually also got, I'm in St. Louis Park. We also got roughly a foot over the last couple of days. It's not blowing like it sounds it is up there. Is Ely a town where when a big front moves through like this, is the whole town just shut down?
Not really. I mean, like everyone else in the state, we're hardy Midwesterners. We are used to winter. And especially this year, I say it's our first snowfall of the year, but it's really our only snowfall of the year. It doesn't affect my day-to-day much. And I can say that because I walk to work. I work 4 blocks away from where I live, so I have that convenience. But I wouldn't say town has been bustling the last couple of days, but people have been out and about helping each other push cars out and shovel sidewalks. And I mean, we're all kind of giddy about it. Some people are bitter about having this much snow this late in the year, but I missed it. My dog missed it. He was frolicking and rolling around in the snow, and you could just see how excited he was for snow. So I kind of have that same feeling. And I think many of us who chose to live in Ely did so for the winters. You really have to like winters to live in this town. We're only 12 miles as the crow flies from the Canadian border. So we're all kind of intentionally up here to enjoy all the seasons, and we finally got winter. So it's been a fun atmosphere the last couple of days.
I mean, it's what you sign up for when you live up there, right?
Absolutely.
Before we get too deep into some Boundary Waters talk and getting people ready for this for the upcoming season here, give us a little background on yourself. I know you're originally from Hutchinson, same hometown as Maxwell, coincidentally enough. But how did you end up living in Ely and working up there?
Yeah. Well, it all started as an early teenager for me. And by that, I mean my infatuation with the outdoors. I grew up playing sports. I grew up, you know, going down to a cabin in southern Iowa and enjoying that experience with family. But I really couldn't consider myself an outdoorsman until later in life, my mid to late 20s. And it all kind of started, that passion for the outdoors started at a summer camp of all places. I can't remember how old I was. I think the second canoe trip adventure I took was at the age of 16. So my first one was probably at the age of 13. And I was not really interested in the traditional summer camp where, you know, you stay in cabins and you do arts and crafts and things like that. So I sought out the special smaller form classes where we would actually go into the woods. And the canoe trip piqued my interest. I'd been canoeing with my family before, but I'd never been on an overnight canoe trip. And by then I had started, you know, getting a passion for fishing. So I thought that was perfect. I brought my cousin along, who's from Iowa. And we just had an absolute blast. I think due to permitting restrictions, we didn't actually go into the Boundary Waters. I think with our group and two counselors, we were like 10 or 11 people, which would have violated the Boundary Waters rules and regulations. So we kind of paddled the periphery. I think we were on the Burntside River and Burntside Lake, just west, if I'm remembering correctly, of Ely. But that's kind of all where it started. And since those two trips as a young teenager, I've kind of been obsessed with all things outdoors. I didn't take my first official Boundary Waters trip until after college at the age of 22. Me and some buddies graduated, and that was kind of our celebration. We went on a July trip. And had an absolute blast. I didn't start hunting until I was 27. I was one of those people who had to take firearm safety training courses as, you know, an adult when usually you're 12, 13, 14 years old. So I definitely kind of came to my outdoorsmanship, or whatever you want to call it, later in life than most. I had a grandfather who hunted and fished. My father didn't do a whole lot of it, so it kind of skipped a generation. I didn't know what I wanted to go to college for, but I knew where I wanted to be. So I picked University of Minnesota, Duluth. At that point, I declared as a engineering major because my dad was an engineer and I was good at math and science, and it made sense to me. Didn't want the big city, the U of M, where my older brother went. I really wanted to move further north. I wanted a smaller town, a more intimate community, and I wanted to be close to northern Minnesota, where I visited many times the North Shore, gone up to Grand Marais and Ely a few times with that summer camp. So I spent 4 years at UMD, did a lot of hiking and backpacking on the Spear Hiking Trail, and then took my first official trip, as a 22-year-old. Fast forward past grad school, I lived in Washington, D.C. for a year and a half. After grad school, I went to Colorado, and I've been back in Minnesota since the summer of 2012, most recently living and working in St. Paul. I've always kind of been a part of the outdoor industry. In college, I put myself through college partially by working at Duluth Pack in Canal Park, another outdoor shop. I worked at an outdoor shop in DC called Hudson Trail Outfitters. And then one of my first serious big boy jobs was an independent sales rep in the outdoor industry. So I was the independent third party who was in charge of selling gear, for multiple different vendors and distributors to local gear shops. So over the years, I worked with those local gear shops here in Minnesota and across the Midwest, based out of St. Paul. But I kind of always found myself wanting for more. I started seriously taking Boundary Waters trips when I moved back to Minnesota. And I think since the year of 2015, don't quote me on this, but I've been in the Boundary Waters for fishing opener every single one of those years up until now, with the exception of 1 year I got stuck in Colorado as a sales rep. I had a flight that got canceled due to some mechanical issues. So I feel like that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back when I missed my, me and my buddy's tradition, our fishing opener trip in the Boundary Waters. I decided, that I needed to move closer to the Boundary Waters, spend more time in the Boundary Waters, or at least northern Minnesota. So I started job searching in 2017, 2018, and a position kind of just fell in my lap. My current employer, Paragus Northwoods Company here in Ely, at that time, at the end of 2018, lost a retail manager and they needed to fill the position. And as a rep, I had worked with them, worked with their buyers. And I didn't know if my family was ready for a move. We had just bought our house about a year earlier in St. Paul. My wife, Lacey, and I, and our dog, Wendell, who's in many of the Farwater videos. You guys probably know him. I wasn't sure if we were ready for a move. So I called our gear buyer. Her name's Delana. At that time, she was the one I worked with the most as an independent sales rep. And I asked her what it was like to live in Ely, what it was like to live in a small town, what it was like to work, you know, in a tight-knit community for a family-owned and operated business that had been around for almost 45 years now. And she talked my ear off for 45 minutes about how wonderful the company is to work for, how awesome Ely is, and how it changed her life for the better. I think she met her husband up here. She had kids. She just wouldn't shut up about how awesome Ely is and how wonderful it is to live on the doorstep or the gateway to the Boundary Waters. So I decided I'd come up and interview. A week later, I drove up. It was mid-October, close to my birthday, which is the 15th, and I remember a snowstorm. And I got there, and the folks who were interviewing me were, like, apologizing for the snow. They're like, oh, it came early. This is October. We're so sorry. I hope your drive went well. I hope you were safe. And I was like, are you kidding me? I love snow. I love the fall. I love this. This is what I want more of. The Twin Cities, you know, at that time kind of had less than ideal winters. We were getting less snowfall, warmer winters, and I wanted more of that. So interview went well, and kind of the rest is history. I think we put our house on the market a week after I got the offer from Paragus, and we sold it the day that we put it on the market, and I moved to Ely 2 weeks later, and my wife followed me in January of 19. That was October of 2018. So I've been here ever since. I spend as much time as I possibly can in the wilderness. I've started doing more backcountry fishing, more backcountry hunting. I've really gotten into foraging these last few years, most specifically wild edible mushrooms, which is a whole nother story and podcast we could talk about. But yeah, I just can't get enough of it. My cup is full when I go into the woods, and being able to live, work, and play in Ely is phenomenal for me. I don't imagine anywhere else that I would be this happy than here in Ely. So yeah, it's been fantastic. Sorry, that was a whole lot of information, but I feel passionately about this subject.
Yeah.
No, all's good. It's good. It's good. I love that stuff. It's funny you talk about the foraging. I don't know if you saw me like scowl a little bit. I hate wild mushrooms.
Really?
And yeah, my dad owns a farm, and he always gets people coming out there asking if they can go look for mushrooms in his woods, and I never really understood it, the craze, or got behind it. It's also funny you mentioned the story about missing fishing opener. I've been talking about it in my friend group. We're all in a wedding the weekend of fishing opener this year.
Uh-oh.
Whose fault is that?
Well, the groom's not, he goes fishing, but I don't know if he necessarily does like an opener trip every year. And I think they got a good deal on the place, but it has been a little bit of a point of contention amongst a friend group. Like, dude, really? Fishing opener? That's a no-no. And normally my brother and I go up to Mille Lacs, but they changed the regulations this year back to you can't keep any walleyes. So not only can I not go fishing on opener, like the main lake that I cruise up to for a day of fishing, I have to find a different lake to go to now. So a bunch of drama in my household around the fishing opener too. I love the backstory though. At some point in there, you started the YouTube channel. I don't think we quite got the backstory of that. How did that come about, the creation of that? And what's some of the content that you're putting out with it?
Yeah. When I moved here in 2018, it was in the fall, so I didn't get to do any Boundary Waters trips that fall. The summer of 2019 was phenomenal for me. I was like a kid in a candy store, and we haven't talked at all about Quetico Provincial Park on the other side of the border. But for those of you who aren't familiar, Quetico Provincial Park is basically Ontario's version of the Boundary Waters. It's roughly the same size at 2 million square acres. It's shaped a little bit differently. It's like a big blob in the middle of southwestern Ontario rather than the Boundary Waters, which is kind of a strip along the border. So it's a lot more remote. The regulations are a little bit different. The main takeaway is it's the same size as the Boundary Waters, and it gets somewhere between 5 and 8% of the visitors that the Boundary Waters does. So it's far more remote. It's just as big of an area, and it's phenomenal. For those of you who haven't visited, I would highly recommend it. The permitting's a little different. It's a little more expensive because they charge you per day rather than just one flat rate for people in your trip. But anyway, all of this is to say that 2019 was my first experience in Quetico. I went three times that year, three different trips, one in August, one at the end of September to close out lake trout season, which has become another tradition with me and my friends, and then one in mid-October for my birthday. And all three of those trips were phenomenal. We had a lot of fun. We caught a ton of fish. And of course, I had my phone along and I took pictures and I took videos when I could, but I couldn't help but thinking, man, if I had like an actual video camera or some GoPros along, this would be some legendary content. The fishing is world class. The scenery, of course, is gorgeous. Like, how disappointing that we didn't have cameras along. So that's part of it. I guess part two, so I guess just wanting to capture my memories, my trips, do trip reports. Part two is I really, really, really like teaching people about this stuff. I really like, so to back up a little bit, when I first started getting into Boundary Waters travel and more specifically backcountry angling, there were almost zero resources out there. And bait shops in the area, which they've changed. I love the bait shops in the area now. But when I came up here in the early 20-teens, no one would give away information unless you were willing to drop $400 to $600 a day on hiring a guide. They didn't tell you what the fish were biting on. They didn't share locations. I just found it really hard, and the barrier to entry was really high. If I didn't live in Ely at that point, I was kind of frustrated because how would I ever gain this knowledge? How would I ever shorten that learning curve? So my frustrating experience when I was first, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and wanted to learn and consume everything I could about the Boundary Waters was really a negative. It was really a turn off, and I was really disappointed in the lack of, at least what I could find, the lack of community and information out there that was free to consume. So what better way to disseminate free information than YouTube? And the YouTube format is just fantastic for me. I like to talk. I like to teach, which is what I've done kind of in my professional career as well. I find taking difficult high level stuff and distilling it and making it digestible for others is something I'm really passionate about. And of course, just selfishly having these memories, as an older person, eventually I won't be able to do these crazy long trips, portages over land, miles and miles of paddling, 15-hour days. So at some point I'm going to want to have these memories to enjoy later. So what better way than, you know, to preserve them on YouTube and be able to watch them later on. And yes, to answer the question you didn't ask, of course I watch my own YouTube videos. We all do it. So yeah, I guess desire to learn, desire to teach, and yeah, shortening the learning curve for others. And that's what's been, you know, the most rewarding part of creating these YouTube videos, which is of course a ton of work, is the overwhelming support I've got from the community of enthusiasts who are really happy to have this content to watch, both for recreational purposes and literally to learn. We only get an average canoe trip is probably three and a half days for the average person. For most people, it's not even their primary vacation for the year. So when you have such limited time in such a wonderful area, you really want to maximize your time setting up camp, traveling, cooking, fishing, whatever. So being able to shorten the learning curve for others and literally help them guarantee a more fulfilling experience for them in the woods is incredibly fulfilling for me. So I guess that's the answer as to why Farwater was started and why I go through all the effort to create this channel.
I mean, you got to watch your own product back, right? Like how do you get better? How do you improve if you're not listening or watching the material that you're putting out? I know we do the same stuff with our podcast too. So Totally get it. I know you've mentioned in a couple of the videos I watched are in that Quetico Park. I've always kind of heard about it, but I don't know too much about it. What's the best way to get there coming from the metro area? I know it's in, I think you said, Southwest Ontario. Is it a significantly more travel time to get there than it is to get, you know, maybe to like Ely or the Gunfoot Trail or something?
Not necessarily. So there's a couple of ways to access the park. The easiest would be more driving time, but it would be driving through International Falls, like an international checkpoint, going through the border, like many of you have done before, giving them your paperwork, having your passport, all of that stuff, then them sending you across, and then you driving to one of the entry points on the other side after getting your permit, just like you would in the Boundary Waters, or going through an outfitter to reserve gear, whatever. Obviously, you have to have Ontario fishing license, and there's different regulations on a different permitting process because they're separate government entities on the other side of the border. But that would be the easiest way. It would be a little bit more time consuming, but that would be the easiest. The way that us locals go through, and a way that a majority of people coming from the south, so Americans, go into Quetico, is going through one of the checkpoints via the Boundary Waters. So the easiest one to get to is from Moose Lake. So there's a Moose Lake, we call it the Moose Lake chain. And that's one of the border areas where you can have motorized boats if you have the proper permitting. So the easiest way for us to do it is paddle that 5.5 miles up Moose Lake, or pay someone to tow us up Moose Lake to save that time. They drop us off at a ranger station called Prairie Portage. And that's where you would get your permit printed, filled out. You would go through all the rules, talk to a ranger, and then they would send you on your way. Before that, obviously, you have to reserve your permit so that when you go to pick it up, it's there. And then the one tricky part, since you're crossing not at a certified checkpoint, is getting what is called the RABC, the Remote Area Border Crossing Permit. It's basically just a background check for the Canadian government. You're telling them, I'm going to cross the border, not at a checkpoint with police officers and all of that, I guess, federal officers. So you're basically telling them in a couple of weeks, I think it's good for a calendar year, actually, but you're basically telling them, I'm going to enter Canada via the border at a Quetico Ranger Station, not at International Falls. So it's basically just a background check. You pay like a $35 or $45 processing fee. Canada has some specific rules and regulations. If you have a DUI, you're not allowed in. If you've got a felony, you're not allowed in. So they just want to make sure that you're someone they want to let in their country. And you're obviously not going to be going through the actual law enforcement process in person. So they just want to check out that you are who you say you are. So once you have your ducks in a row, really the only hurdle is that extra fee. They charge per day per person, as opposed to a flat rate for the entire trip. Whether you go for 2 days or 15 days in the Boundary Waters, you're going to spend the same amount of money. That's not the case for Quetico. They charge you based on usage, which makes sense to me. Like, someone who's going for 15 days is obviously going to have a bigger impact on the park than somebody who's going for 2 days. So I understand that permitting process. But yeah, most people think it's well worth it to jump through the extra hoops to go to the Quetico, you know, to get away from the crowds a little bit, which of course have been increasing in the last couple of years since the pandemic increased the popularity of the Boundary Waters.
I got my map pulled up on my other screen here looking at the Moose Lake entry points. So I know you also work for that outfitter. Would that be something that they could help you arrange? Because even to me, I've done a handful of Boundary Water trips. The international stuff seems a little bit daunting. Is that a main area where an outfitter would come in and help you organize and get all of your ducks in a row, give you the transportation to get a haul up Moose Lake, kind of help you figure out where you're going to go to the ranger station when you cross the border to check in, all of those good things?
Absolutely. I couldn't recommend going through an outfitter more for your first Quetico experience, especially. The last thing you would want to happen is forget to dot your I's and cross your T's and have a trip be affected. And there is there is more to take into account with Quetico. They also have different regulations on fishing. Absolutely no live bait, no organic bait. Like, you can't even dig your own worms at a campsite. So there are several rules that are a lot more strict. So going through an outfitter ensures that you've got all that legal paperwork in order and you've done all the proper research before you enter the park. So yeah, I couldn't recommend using an outfitter more, whether it's only to book a permit or whether it's a fully guided outfitted trip. It's totally a great idea to go with an outfitter. And, you know, just like I claim, you know, I like to think my YouTube channel does, it shortens the learning curve. Let them handle all the complicated details, and all you have to worry about is, you know, your route and what you want to do on your trip, what you want to focus on and accomplish. So yeah.
How much longer, like, would you need to get all the way into the park? How much time would this add to your trip? Let's say you're in Ely and you want to get into Quetico, that route, is it like an extra half day each way that you would want to plan for?
If you're willing to pay for a tow up Moose Lake, I mean, I can be at my house and an hour and probably 45 minutes later, I can have my Quetico permit in hand. It takes me about half an hour to drive to Moose Lake. If the towboat driver is waiting for me, we can throw the canoe on the boat. They have those racks on top of the John boats. So you flip the canoe over, they tie it down, you throw your packs in, you throw your food pack or your barrel, you throw your fishing rods in, and then it's only 5 miles by boat. They can only use 25 horsepower motors, but maybe a half an hour total to do that 5 miles. They drop you off, and as long as there's not someone in front of you in line at Prairie Portage, like, you can get your permit within 15 minutes. And then maybe 20 minutes to go through the rules of the park and ask any questions you may have, and then they send you on your way. So for me, it doesn't really add that much time at all. Sometimes I've chose, rather than paying for a tow, to get up early and paddle, just to be there as early as possible when the ranger station opens, I think at 8 a.m. during the season. And that may add, for me and my buddies who travel a little faster, because we're a little more conditioned to Boundary Waters traveling fast and light, takes us about 2 hours to get from Moose Lake to Prairie Portage. So yeah, worst case scenario, it adds somewhere between an hour and 45 minutes and 4 or 5 hours for most groups. So not even half a day.
That's really good intel. I kind of know where I want to do my next big trip into the Boundary Waters is just take a Canada trip. Thankfully, I don't have any DUIs on my record, so I hope they'll let me in.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple different times, like, the increase in the influx of people that you're seeing into the Boundary Waters. I know a big thing we wanted to talk about is, if somebody's looking at getting a permit and planning a trip, especially early season, how far in advance should they be thinking about getting a permit and picking out a route?
Yeah. What we tell people when they outfit through us and we're helping them build their trips, the most important thing, first and foremost, is hammer out your dates. Obviously, when you're going to friends or family members, there's a lot of schedules to coordinate. So before we talk about any of the logistics of the trip, get your dates figured out. Once you have dates, as you know from booking permits in the Boundary Waters, all that needs to stay the same is the trip leader and the alternate leader. You can add people, you can subtract people, you can add boats, you can subtract boats, you can do a fully guided trip or not, you can do a meal plan through your outfitter or do your food yourself. So first and foremost is getting the dates. The way that the permit booking process works for the Boundary Waters, it's not a rolling basis like you see for some national parks. This is a wilderness area. So all of the permits for the year, and when I say year, I'm talking about bookable permits, which are May 1st through the last day of September, which is September 30th. Outside of those dates, so October 1st all the way up to April 30th. I think there's 30 days in April. Those are just self-service. You don't need to book those permits ahead of time. It's a carbon copy. You fill it out at the entry point and you can stay as long as you want, and they're free because those are the times of the year that not very many people visit the Boundary Waters. For the permits, May 1 through the end of September, those all go on sale the third Wednesday in January at 9 a.m. every single year, the whole slew of permits during that time period. So I would recommend absolutely, with the increase in popularity in the boundary waters, that you're ready to go at 8:58 a.m. You're logged into your recreation.gov site. You've got everything ready to go and you're hitting refresh. I've done that pretty much every year since I've moved up here, and a couple years when I lived in the cities, and I've never not gotten the entry point that I wanted. Sometimes I have to go a day later or a day earlier, which can affect you, especially on a fishing opener trip. You don't want to go in the Saturday of fishing opener. Usually I like to paddle in on Friday and get camp set up and get ready to fish that next morning, first light. But if you're ready to go, generally speaking, you don't have a difficult time getting a permit. Obviously, there are popular times to go, like the Thursday and Friday before Memorial Day weekend, the Thursday and Friday before Labor Day weekend, the weekend before and after 4th of July, depending on when that hits. So sometimes you have to fight people for those permits, and not all permits are created equal. Some entry points have one permit per day. Some entry points have upwards of almost 20 permits per day, depending on what pressure that area can take, how many campsites they have, how many routes you can do from those entry points. So at times, people, even if they're waiting at 9 a.m., may not get the first permit they want. But if you have a backup, if you have other plans, even if you have rigid dates, 99 times out of 100, you can get one of your top two choices. The other caveat is what's happening since the increase in popularity of the boundary waters since the pandemic is people are overbooking, which is really frustrating. And the Forest Service hasn't figured out a way to police this. But for example, if me and my buddies wanted to go in on fishing opener Friday and we had Moose River North as our first permit and Fall Lake as our second permit and Moose Lake as our third permit, we could have a different person book a permit for each one of those days at different entry points and then cancel them last minute, which is technically allowed if a different person is booking, but it kind of bends the rules. And it's also reserving permits you know you're not going to use. So that's frowned upon, but it's a reality. The whole point of me saying that is cancellations have also gone up since the pandemic and the increase in popularity. So if you're someone who lives in the cities and you have a relatively flexible job, you didn't get the permit you're looking for, watch that permit grid for cancellations, especially within 5 to 10 days of your desired date. I should say 5 to 10 days out from the current date, you'll start to see permits come back on the grid. So if you're diligent, if you watch that grid, if you're flexible with entry point, which is something I recommend, be flexible. There are many different wonderful entry points and areas to explore. Don't get stuck on one. Use an outfitter to plan, especially if you don't get your first choice. You can always snatch one up. That's not going to help somebody, of course, driving from Alabama, who has to have those dates and entry points set in stone before they leave. But for anyone who lives within a couple hundred miles, if you're willing to be flexible, you'll always be able to get a permit. It may not be your first choice. And the other thing I haven't mentioned is day permits are free and unlimited. There's no quota on day use permits. So worst case scenario, you don't get your permit, come up to Ely, rent a cabin, stay at an Airbnb, stay at one of the hotels, sleep in a bed at night, and take day trips into the boundary waters. If you're up here for a week, you could explore 5 to 6 different entry points. You could fish different areas. You could do picnics. You could do day trips. There are other ways to explore the boundary waters than just doing the typical 3 to 7 day overnight trip. So flexibility is key when booking permits.
You know, they're going to have to add some sort of cancellation fees to try to discourage people from booking multiples and then canceling. Do they have like wait lists? So if like you were watching an entry point, do they have like wait lists where you could get emailed something when a spot becomes available or anything?
Short answer is no. The Forest Service doesn't offer that. But one really good resource is bwca.com. And I believe, don't quote me on this, I've never used this tool, but I believe somebody built a tool to set up alerts when certain days and certain entry points come available when someone cancels. So I think you can get on a third party watchdog site through bwca.com to set that up. But the Forest Service doesn't allow for a wait list necessarily. There are very small penalties for canceling if you don't cancel within 2 weeks of your trip. So if you cancel within 2 weeks of your trip, you don't get your processing fees back. You get your permit fee back, but all the processing fees, I think, are forfeited. So you lose a little bit of money, but generally the $15 to $18 or whatever it is not enough incentive for people to cancel those earlier or avoid, you know, booking multiple permits. So it's kind of a self-policing policy right now.
Eric, since the pandemic, and we've seen the visitation to that area increase a lot, have you noticed like just a little bit more buzz in the area as far as not just on trips, but in Ely and also the trips themselves? Like, have you felt, I know they limit the amount of permits, but have you felt like it's, you know, parking's harder and finding the site that you want maybe a little bit tougher? Have you felt that larger amount of participation and interest in the Boundary Waters at all?
Yeah, in many, many, many different ways. First and foremost is something you didn't even ask about, but just the amount of people moving to Ely and the businesses popping up. We, like any small town right now, are really struggling finding enough workers, finding housing for the workforce. So we have our struggles as a small tourist-based economy and growing. But housing prices, I won't use the word skyrocketed, but they have significantly increased since I moved here and my wife and I bought a house in 2019. We got in right before the pandemic and feel very lucky in our timing. In terms of the actual busyness of the Boundary Waters and being able to get the permit I want, I do and I don't notice that at the same time. So where most people are noticing lack of campsites, difficulty on portages because there's 8 groups in front of them, bears at campsites because of the garbage, the mess, the increased use, those are almost always on those first entry point lakes or the next lakes. So like I said earlier, the average canoe trip, at least for our customers at Paragus, is about 3.5 days. So 4 days and 3 nights. Most people don't have the ability to get 15, 20, 30 miles deep if you got to turn around, you know, after a day and a half of travel. So most people are paddling in somewhere between 3 and 5 miles and finding a campsite that they stay at for the entirety of the trip, or they're maybe leapfrogging to one lake, one portage deep. So the number one thing I recommend that people can do to avoid this is get an early start. Like, I always try to paddle, and I'm busy in the summer. I work in a tourist economy, so I can't take weeks and weeks off during the busy season. But always start paddling as close to sunup as possible. The horror stories you hear about people not being able to find a campsite are almost always groups that started late in the day and they're not looking for a campsite until 2 or 3 p.m. and they're on lakes that are really close to entry points, put in takeout lakes. So I always recommend getting up as early as possible, hitting water as early as possible, coming the night before and staying in a hotel rather than driving up the morning of, to avoid those issues. Getting an early start is really important. So me, on my trips, I always get a very early start and I always spend the first day paddling as much as I can. So I get, you know, 4 to 6 lakes deep on my first day, which most people don't even do in a week long trip. And I have the ability to go fast and light. I've conditioned my body to travel really quickly in the backcountry. So I'm a little bit privileged in that respect, not to mention, like, I have a bed to sleep in here in Ely. I don't have to pay for a hotel. So take everything I say with a grain of salt, of course. But I really, I mean, I've just made it paramount on my trips to get deep into the wilderness on day one. And you can still have that wilderness experience where you run into maybe one group in a day or 2-3 groups over the course of a couple of days, but you have to be willing to work for it. You have to get deep. You got to start early. And you got to be a little bit strategic about your entry points as well. Avoid the super popular entry points on the big lakes with, you know, lots of campsites. That's where most of the bottleneck and the problems, across the board, whether it's, you know, bears, garbage around campsites, overcrowding, that kind of thing, almost always happens right next to the entry point.
It's funny you say the bear comment, because this fall I was at Agnes, Lake Agnes, and we found at the site we were staying Must have been like a separate bag they had where they were keeping their food and cookingware and all that stuff. And like, because it was just ransacked and spread out all over the place and licked clean by a bear, obviously. And we, throughout the trip, kind of got off and checked out a couple of the other sites that were vacant that trip and found similar remnants at these sites. Like, we even found like a couple pairs of shoes, just like really weird things that we were finding evidence of bear. Thankfully, we never ran into this bear, but I'm wondering if that's all as a result of just a lot more people visiting that area and the bears are interested in what they're bringing. So I had never seen that before.
That happens a lot. And Agnes is one of the most infamous lakes for bears because it's so popular for a reason. It's really good fishing. Most groups can get there in a day. Phenomenal campsites, gorgeous water, beautiful scenery. It's on the doorstep of Lac La Croix, which is a phenomenal lake. Mm-hmm. But the Forest Service and the DNR say is a fed bear is a dead bear. Like, these bears, once they find an easy meal at a campsite, literally, it's like a guy or gal hitting up their trap line in the woods. They go from campsite to campsite, circling the lake. I heard a story from a customer once who said they could literally, they were on Nenemoose Lake, south of Agnes, and they could literally pretty much time the bear as it went from campsite to campsite. Because obviously what you're told is when a bear comes into camp, you throw rocks at it, you bang pots and pans together, you scream really loud, you make a huge ruckus. So this person was sitting on the other side of the lake and they could literally hear as the bear went to each campsite, and you'd hear screaming and people going crazy. Then it'd be quiet for 20 minutes. And then the next campsite would just get loud and raucous, and then it'd get quiet for 20 minutes. So bears are advantageous feeders. And I talk about fish being advantageous feeders too. They're always going to find the easiest meal possible to expend the least amount of energy. So when a bear learns that it can get an easy meal at a campsite, it's going to go back and do that over and over again. Obviously, there's other environmental factors, like the drought year bears were really, really bad because they didn't have berries to eat, which is one of their main sources of calories mid to late summer. So there's other things that affect that. But once a person conditions a bear that campsites mean food, then that bear is in a lot of trouble because the DNR has got to come in and euthanize that bear because they can live for a long time and they'll keep doing that over and over again. So that has to do with careless campers, people who think it's funny to feed animals, and then obviously overuse, garbage, people not cleaning up campsites, etc.
Yeah, that's crazy. I want to pivot to this year in particular and get your thoughts on the start of permit season, May 1st. You know, we've had an odd winter, to say the least, and I don't know what your thoughts are on, like, how that'll impact fishing, your travel, ice out would be another thing I'd like to ask you what your thoughts are, the water temp. All of these conditions might be a little bit, maybe a lot different than we're used to, like, especially, I think, the last 2 or 3 years when fishing opener is, like, immediately after the ice is out.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen this firsthand, and the most traction I've ever got on my YouTube channel is posting my ice out videos that I've done the last 2, maybe 3 years. And so the last 2 years, what you're alluding to, our average ice out in the Ely area for Shagwa, just north of town, is a really good bellwether lake. Because it's deep, but not crazy deep. It's shallow, but not crazy shallow. There's a little bit of flowing water, but not a crazy amount of flowing water. The average for Shagwa is usually between April 25th and May 1st. So an average ice out is usually about 2 weeks before fishing opener. And the DNR sets fishing opener based on, you know, when the walleye and the pike are going to go up into the streams, the shallow, warmer water, and start to spawn. The last 2 years, we've had an ice out, I believe, May 10th, 2 years ago, and May 9th, which is anywhere from 1 to 2 days before fishing opener. So what we've seen the last 2 years is a crazy late ice out where everybody is super nervous about their trips not being able to happen, not being able to paddle, ice being on lakes, the water being way too cold for the fishing to be good. And everybody's been searching online, which is why my ice out videos, my ice report, have done so well the last couple of years. This year, if you had asked me a week and a half ago before the forecast for this storm, we locals were all pushing for maybe a March ice out. I think the earliest I've ever heard from the folks who've been here, I can't remember the year, but a little over a decade and a half ago, they had an ice out that I think was like March 19th or March 21st or something like that. So crazy early. It's possible. And we had the conditions all winter long, mild temps and a lack of snowfall, to encourage a really early ice out. And we were expecting an ice out potentially before April 1st. The last time I went fishing was out on Snowbank probably 3 weeks ago now, and there was still 16 inches of ice. It was starting to break up at the shorelines. There were pressure ridges because it had been really windy and the ice was smashing into itself. But the ice was still really healthy and still really good over the deep parts of the lake. We got a couple of warm snaps after that, and this ice continues to pull away from shorelines. So we were looking at an early ice out. Now that we've gotten all this snow, it's insulated the ground, which is fantastic for the drought. It's soaked everything, or will when it starts to melt. But it's also insulating that lake ice. I think, fortunately, due to the lack of cold temperatures, there's not enough ice right now to remain buoyant with all the weight of snow on top of it. So what's happening right now is there's a massive amount of snow on thin amounts of ice, probably anywhere from 8 to 12 inches, and it's forcing that ice down under the water. Lake levels are rising and the water is coming up over and creating slush, which is going to encourage ice out. So we get a bunch of wind, a bunch of sunshine, and of course, what helps it the most is warmth and rain. We still could be looking at, I would bet money on like an April 15th, like a tax day ice out, which is 3 weeks earlier than it has been the last 2 years, which really does affect the fishing. Sorry, long answer to a short question. I think the number one thing we're going to see for fishing opener weekend in the Boundary Waters this year is water temps that are probably somewhere between 10 and 12, if not 15 degrees warmer than they were last year. 2 years ago, I went up to Knife Lake for fishing opener, and we were literally a day ahead of the ice out. And we registered, I think, 47.9 degree water when we got to Knife Lake. And the warmest we saw was near an outflow near Eddy Falls, where there was a bunch of water rushing in. And I think that was like 51 degrees. Last year, same thing. I was up on Lac La Croix, crazy late ice out. We got up there and we were seeing temperatures of 49, 50, 51, 52. Walleye spawn in that 42 to 50 degree range. Pike spawn in that 42 to 50 degree range. They don't care what time of year it is. They're waiting for the water temperatures to warm up so that they can move up and expend their energy to spawn in the shallow water, generally shallow sandy areas or slow moving water coming out of a lake, usually an outlet from a river or a stream. So when we were fishing on Knife Lake, we caught a couple of walleyes and they were just fat, pregnant females. So we stopped walleye fishing. We didn't want to harass the fish in the middle of the spawn when they're the most vulnerable. So we caught a couple of walleyes and had a good time, but walleye fishing was basically out of the question for us just due to ethical reasons. We didn't want to harass them. So we switched over to lake trout, which are a whole different story. Last year, the same thing. We couldn't catch a fish to save our life until we moved to the outlet of flowing water and found warmer water. So I guess my key to fishing this time of year is finding the warmest water on the lake, wherever that may be. Generally speaking, that's moving water, which doesn't have to mean a stream outlet or inlet. It could be a windblown shoreline where the warm water off the surface kind of has been tumbling across the lake and smashing into rocks. It can be south facing shorelines that get more sun during the day. It can be rocks or sandy flats that generate and absorb more heat throughout the day and warm the water. But shallow water, shallow moving water for me is key. So I think anyone going out fishing this year is probably going to have a slightly tougher time. We hit it too early the last 2 years, and we're probably going to hit it too late this year. Generally, what you want is for those fish to be post-spawn. So they're done up in the shallows and they've started moving back to that 4 to 12 foot range. They're still concentrated in high numbers, but now they're feeding rather than being obsessed with spawning and producing offspring. They're now recovering and eating and in shallow water, shallow enough to target. So for me, water temp is the number one thing for fishing early in the season. And that took me a long time to figure out because, again, I didn't have any YouTube channels about fishing in the boundary waters to watch. There were plenty of angling videos on bigger lakes down south, which generally were many degrees warmer that same weekend. So I really would have loved someone to tell me that. Look for the warmest water on the lake and you're going to have the most success early season.
How about bugs? What do you think the earlier on bug hatch is probably going to be affecting those trips too, don't you think?
Yeah. Generally up here, and I still haven't had a year where it's been like this, so I'm interested to see what fishing opener is like. But generally the years I've come up here, whatever it is, 8 out of the 9 years or 7 out of the 8 years, the water temps have been cold and it's just been too cold for mosquitoes. It's been too cold for mayflies. So we haven't had to worry about it. In a normal year, you shouldn't have to worry about bugs until closer to Memorial Day weekend. What I've found is that doesn't necessarily negatively affect fishing if you're willing to be versatile and change your approach. So early in the season, and we're not talking lake trout here necessarily. We're talking more pike, bass, and walleye. But early in the season, I refer to that as a minnow bite. So all the way up to June 1st, when those smallmouths start moving up shallow and spawning, they spawn a little bit warmer water in about 60 degrees. I refer to that as a minnow bite. So whether that's a crankbait like a Rapala or Berkeley Flicker Shad, whether that's a literal minnow on a jig or a hook under a bobber, or a soft plastic, if that's your preference. What I'm using for bait most closely relates to what they're trying to eat, which is the minnows that spawn at roughly the same time the big fish spawn. Again, that's by moving water. That's up shallow. That's in the warm, usually current-filled water. I believe the minnows spawn at the same time or right after the walleye and the northern. So match the hatch, whatever the fish are keying in on, wherever their food source is, you want to be at that location with something that closely imitates that. And early season from ice out, anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the weather after that, minnows is my number one bait. Once the mayfly hatch happens, once leeches start to spawn or reproduce, whatever you call it, once there are more invertebrates in the water that the fish are eating, then we switch to the bug bite. So crankbaits will still work. Like, fish love minnows. That's their number one food source. But generally the bugs are plentiful. So when I say switch to the bug bite, I'm talking about leeches, night crawlers, people who fly fish, switch to your fly fishing gear, match the hatch again. Once those bugs have hatched and that's a big food source for them, they're not going to pay quite as much attention to the minnows up shallow. Not to mention the water is getting warmer up shallow, so they're going to move deeper naturally.
I don't want you to give away all of your spots, but what are some good or popular ice out early season fishing lakes or entry points to get into?
Yeah. Again, I'm going to hammer this one hard because more important than location is moving water. So what I really like to focus on early season is anything that kind of feels like a river system. Crooked Lake is extremely popular. It's more like, and the whole border route is like this, but it's more like a giant ancient river that has since receded. And it's like pool 1, 2, 3 of the Mississippi River. It's the same thing up here. Crooked Lake is more like Wednesday Bay, Thursday Bay, Friday Bay, Saturday, Sunday Bay are more like pools of a river system. So anywhere a mass volume of water is concentrated in a small area, whether it's literally a river or just pinch points between islands and structure, whatever, find that moving water. The Kuishui River is also a very fantastic place early season. Lakes 1, 2, 3, and 4 and Insula Lake into Alice are also part of the Kuishui River. I refer to that as the Kuishui River system. It's the Insula pool, the Alice pool, whatever. There's moving water through that entire system. So for example, a lake like Snowbank, that's relatively landlocked, doesn't have a whole lot of inlets and outlets, is not part of a bigger river system. I wouldn't necessarily recommend people fish Snowbank Lake for fishing opener, not to mention it's bigger, it's deeper, it's clearer water that's going to be colder than the river systems around it. So anywhere you can find a river, anywhere you can find moving water, the bottom sides of waterfalls are really popular area, or inlets and outlets. Moving water. That's why Basswood Lake is also a very, very good fishing lake. It's so fertile. There's so many nutrients from the bogs that are dumping into those bodies of water, which obviously attract the minnows, which obviously attract the predator fish. Anywhere you've got that much oxygen and that much nutrients moving into a body of water, you're going to have a healthy forage population, which is going to breed a healthy predator fish population. So sorry, all of my comments are very specific to the west side of the Boundary Waters in Ely. I haven't done as much on the Gunflint side, so I apologize to the folks who want the sweet spots over there. But I'm probably not telling people something they don't already know, that Crooked Lake, the Kwishewe River, and Basswood are good fishing areas. But those are really good models to use just on a larger scale that breed larger fish on average.
Yeah, I know Max and his family love the Gunflint side, but I love going out of Ely. I've actually never gone up over there. I know you said you like to travel fast and light. What are some essential equipment or gear or things that you are must-haves for you, like outside of the obvious things that you need, like canoes or paddles or backpacks or whatever, but what are some essential gear items that you've learned throughout the years that you can't live without when you go on a trip?
Well, the first one might be obvious, but a Kevlar boat. And I say that having traveled in aluminum and fiberglass boats for the first 5 years of my career as a Boundary Waters traveler, just because that's what we could afford, you know, begging from people's, you know, borrowing canoes from people's aunts, uncles, cousins, whatever, was the only way we could afford to make a trip happen. So don't feel bad if you can't afford to rent or purchase a Kevlar boat. They're very expensive, but a Kevlar boat is the modern way to travel through the Boundary Waters. There's many different models. You know, go to your local outfitter and try them all out, demo them, rent different ones on different trips, ask for advice, that kind of thing. But a Kevlar boat is going to be faster on the water. It's sleeker. Most of them are designed to be more streamlined and track really nicely and cover miles. And then obviously the main benefit is carrying them over portages. We're talking anywhere from 25 pounds for a solo boat, all the way up to 55 or 60 pounds for a four person. And then tandem boats in that like 45 to 50 pound range. When you have a boat that one person can carry over a portage and a pack on their back, that really decreases the amount of times that you have to portage, which obviously is the major time suck on any canoe trip. The goal obviously is always single portaging, but I understand that's not a possibility for everyone. I don't single portage very often anymore because I carry camera gear with me. Me and my buddies like ribeye steaks on our first night. We like to have real food, cheese and crackers and meat. We don't like to just eat, you know, dehydrated meal in a bag. So we'll do what I refer to as 1.5 portages. So we'll all take really heavy loads over the portage the first time, and then one or two guys will go back for the last load. So not everyone needs to go back every single portage. And I think that's a really good balance. It still allows you to bring, you know, the creature comforts, a little bit more weight, better food, a bag of wine or a bottle of whiskey, maybe, to enhance your experience without degrading, you know, how you feel physically without killing you on the portages. So finding that balance is really important. In terms of like literal gear, I have lots of gear recommendations, but almost none of them like make me faster or encourage single portaging or, you know, the touring. But the one thing I never go on a trip without is a camp chair. And I figured this out as a 22-year-old. Like, it was not necessarily because I'm an old guy. I'm 37 now, and I'm in relatively good shape, but I mean, there's just something about sitting on a log after sitting in a canoe for hours on end, your body's beat up. It's, you just, whether it's a hammock or a literal chair, just something soft to get you up off the ground. There's a lot of flat, hard surfaces in canoe country And unless you're literally laying down on like a warm rock in the sun, it's not very comfortable to sit on rocks and logs. So a really good camp chair, and technology has come a long way with these camp chairs. They pack down the size to about 1.5 Nalgenes, sub 2 pounds, even lighter. They collapse real small. Generally they're very expensive, but, I mean, I've gone on trips before where we wanted to cut weight and we're like, okay, we got 4 people, we'll bring 2 chairs. And then we just end up fighting over the chairs the whole trip and, you know, disagreeing about whose turn it is to be in the chair. So chair to get you up off the ground to allow your body to recover, is really important. One thing I'll share, it's not necessarily a gear recommendation, but the way I travel with fishing rods, cause I get this question all the time. And I used to be the guy, or we used to be the guys who broke down our fishing rods, brought a plastic rod tube, babied them, tried to like strap them into the boat so we didn't have to carry them on portages. I'll give the Paragus Outfitting crew credit for this because they taught me this method. I won't take credit for it. But we buy a little thing called bungee dealy bobs, which is basically just a little toggle on an elastic strap that lets you cinch things together really tightly and securely. And we will bungee all of our rods together up to 6 at a time. And what we do with those when we're paddling is we stick them straight up out of the back of the boat. So behind the stern paddler, you put the reels down kind of behind their back in that open little cubby that's generally empty and doesn't have anything in it. And then the rod tips are sticking out of the back of the boat. So that way there's no way to throw a pack on them. There's no way to break them inadvertently. They're just sticking straight out. And then we have one person carry them on the portages, one bundle, they're down at their side. If they stumble and fall, you just throw them into the bushes. You don't land on them. We've never broken a rod tip. We've never lost a rod. That is the way to do it. Bungee them together. Obviously take your hooks off, but you can leave your swivels on. You can leave the line and the reels on. And then when you get to an appropriate area where you're fishing, you're base camping, you're stopping for the day, then you undo them, you distribute the rods, and everybody's fishing within 2 to 3 minutes. It's the quickest, it's the easiest, it's the safest, and I've never had a problem with it. That took me years to figure out. So thanks again to the outfitting crew at Paragus for that tip.
I'll have to take that one because we do the big plastic rod holder case. And somebody's got to, you know, add that weight to their canoe for, you know, the trip in and the trip out. So I'll have to grab that name from you after this. But yeah, the chair thing makes me laugh a little bit because I did years and years of the sitting on logs and rocks. And I think it was like 7 years ago, my cousins brought their dad, who was probably pushing 60 at the time. And he brought in, it was a must that he would carry just a regular old lawn chair, and we were all kind of laughing at him. And, because that's just not what we did. And that's, you know, it's like almost like poking fun, like you're weak, you don't need to sit on that. This is, you know, we're roughing it out here. But I think it was a year or two later, somebody found those little camp chairs, those lightweight ones. And now we all have them and they're a must bring. And it's just makes a world of difference. Like you said, after, having zero back support for the entirety of the light hours, to have that around the fire at night is legit. So, yep, I like it.
That's funny. You mentioned how you put them out the back of the canoe. When I watched some of your YouTube videos, I saw it's in the back when you're recording. I could see the rods in the back, and part of me was thinking that you were trying to troll. Or like you were trying to troll, but you weren't going fast enough with your canoeing or something. I was like, what are they doing with those rods back there? They just have like a topwater bait and they're just like canoeing and hoping something hits it. Now it makes sense. That's all for travel.
Yeah. Fishing is always, I mean, on our trips, 9 times out of 10, it's the number one reason we're doing the trip, especially the fishing opener trips. Like, we sometimes have buddies who stay back at camp and they don't go out for the afternoon or the evening fish, but they're almost always dedicated to fishing. And we've brought as many as 3 rods per person before. So having a good system is really important to us. And I'm glad you brought up trolling, because that's another thing that I probably would have never thought about. And me and my minimalist buddies still butt heads over this, but a really good rod holder that clamps onto the gunwale of the boat, that you don't have to screw through a Kevlar boat, something that doesn't damage the wooden or aluminum gunnels is also, I think, really, really important. So I have one made by a company called Ram Mounts, and they do all sort of different mounting equipment for tablet computers, laptops, cameras, whatever. But they make one called a Tough Claw mount that's literally just a wing nut, and then it's got a claw that cinches or clamps down onto any shape of a gunnel as long as it's not bigger than 3 inches in diameter, I believe. And it's got little rubber pads on there so it doesn't damage the gunnel, and you can wrench that thing down as hard as you can get it. And you put your rod in it. It allows you to put your rod perpendicular to your boat when trolling rather than out the side or over your shoulder or wedged in between your legs. That gets the lure away from the boat, which also gets it away from your buddy who's fishing on the other side. So less snags, you're covering more area. Yeah, a good rod holder is indispensable, and that's a pound maybe at the most that I'm happy to carry over portages. It's more comfortable too. I can paddle, you know, put both my hands on the paddle. I'm not trying to hold my rod with one hand and then paddle with the other. And then I literally just watch for when I hook into a fish or get a snag. And if it's a fish, we all in unison paddle as hard as we can for 5 or 6 strokes to set the hook really nicely in that fish. And then I put my paddle down and I grab the reel or the rod and reel, and then I reel it in. So yeah, a really good rod holder is really nice to just save fatigue and literally increase the amount of fish you catch. I think it's another tool that people shouldn't forget.
Going back a little bit, I got to give you crap a little. I know you said that you're like minimalist and you sometimes are light and fast when you're going. If you're packing in full-on ribeye steaks to cook for dinner, that is a full-on meal. That's not quite minimalist. Those must be the trips when you're doing the portage and a halves every time.
Yeah, what me and my buddies really like to do, and we joke about this all the time, it's like, well, just think of how light our pack will be on the second day and the third day. If we're bringing a 5-liter bag of wine and ribeyes, like that first night, we're going to eliminate 10 pounds from our pack. Isn't that amazing? But what we really like to do is bust our butts the first day and the last day when we do these fishing trips. So we spend, again, we like to go in the day before fishing opener. So there's no pressure to get to the lake. We can't fish for most species anyway. We just get as far in as we can. We, of course, have a desired lake or campsite that we're trying to get to. We bust our butts on day one. And then our reward at the end of that day, if the steaks have thawed, are ribeye steaks. And then we can start reducing the amount of weight we've got in our pack. So even if we have to double portage, part of the experience for me is the creature comforts. It is a flask of scotch or nice bourbon, wine with your steaks, fresh food. And then the second half of the trip, we usually sacrifice a little bit. We bring dehydrated meals as a backup if we don't catch fish or whatever. But part of the wilderness experience for me is really good cooking. Like, I love cooking fish over a fire, especially. I love frying fish. I love eating steak in the wilderness. I hunt a lot, so I always try to save wild game to bring into the woods with me. I don't know what it is, but just something about shooting your own deer, processing it, and bringing the backstraps to share with your buddies on fishing opener. Like, there's literally no better feeling for me. Or doing surf and turf. Like, I'm going to bring a steak and we're going to catch a walleye and it's going to be the best meal of our lives. And we're going to go to bed, you know, with full bellies and a glass of wine and have a great time. So that is part of the experience for me. And I also have the privilege of living here. So some trips are a week long and they're base camp and I get to do things like that. And other trips, we leave that at home. I bring one fishing rod, one pack, and we cover as many miles as possible in more of a marathon style trip. We don't stop. We don't base camp. We just see how many miles we can paddle on our weekend away from work when I'm paddling with folks from Paragus or other guides. I mean, there have been trips where we've covered 120 miles in 48 hours. So those trips are a lot of fun, too. They serve their purpose. So what I'm trying to say is I can rough it. I can single portage, but most of the time I choose not to.
I gotcha. Last question before we let you go. We'll give you a couple seconds to think about it, but craziest story that you've either heard or seen or come across personally while out on one of your trips. I'll give you a quick one for me. This isn't probably the craziest, but you'll appreciate it. Talking about fishing rods, Max has heard it before. So we went with some friends during COVID, and half the group had been there before, but half the group hadn't even ever been in a canoe before. So pretty inexperienced mixed group. And we were canoeing. We were on the U.S. side. We were going to go do a day trip out to Canada. So go into Canada, come back, and we were going to kind of fish on our way there. And so we didn't have anything in the boats other than our fishing rods. And we came around an island that we were staying on. It got really windy, and the waves are coming across us. And the lead people in the first canoe flipped, lost their rods. We were able to get them, flip back right, and pull them into shore. So everything was fine, minus their fishing rods had sunk to the bottom. And I gave one of the guys my fishing rod, and he was just casting from our island later in the day, and he snagged something, and he reeled it in. He thought it was a stick. He caught someone else's fishing rod who had also lost their rod, and we reeled it in, and it worked perfectly. And then he just commandeered that rod, and he was catching fish with that rod because his had lost when they capsized their canoe in the waves.
Wow. So it wasn't one of the rods they lost that day. It was literally someone else on a different trip.
Yeah, but it must have been the people that stayed there right before us, because it was in perfect condition. It hadn't been sitting in the bottom of the lake for months. It was like in great condition. Line was still great on it, still casted fine, and he was just catching fish.
That is awesome. Yeah, you're putting me on the spot.
Man, I always have to poke fun at that story. You guys crossing the border illegally or trying to.
Yeah, he had, some of the guys had Dewey's, so they couldn't get the normal permits. No, I'm kidding. That part's not true. The FBI
just got the rundown on the proper way to do it. So rewind.
Well, it's hard to tell where that border line is exactly. You're out there with a paper map. Like, how are you supposed to know?
Exactly.
And then Max told us a story last fall on his same trip with the bear activity that you found other people's utensils and you started just using them as your own. Their forks and spoons.
I mean, there was some stuff there that we, you might find it odd that, you know, it was licked clean, but we did wash them. And there was even a couple maps, and we didn't wear the pairs of shoes we found, but we packed some stuff out, some solid gear.
All right. I think I thought of a story, and I'm not, and unfortunately this didn't happen to me, but I trust the guy who told me the story and it sounds legit. And I'm really not trying to scare your listeners about bears, because I don't think anyone has ever died from a bear interaction or even been seriously hurt in the last couple of decades anyway. So like, bears are not something to worry about in the Boundary Waters. They're just like anything else. Like, honestly, you're much more likely to be hurt by a moose or any other animal in the woods. So I'm not trying to scare people about bears. But during the 2021 drought season, might have been 2020. Anyway, the year is not important. When bears were really bad over on Agnes, the same time frame, on the east side of the Boundary Waters, I can't remember what Gunflint Lake, it was either Seagull, Alpine, or Jasper, but one of those, you know, well-known for bear activity lakes. I talked to a guy who was on a solo trip, and he was on a lake that was really busy. There were other people around, and a bear wandered into his camp. He was by himself. This guy had his conceal and carry permit, so he had a gun on him, but he didn't want to use it against a bear. He brought that. I don't know why you'd bring it. Anyway, that's another story. So he's sitting at camp. He's getting ready to go to bed. He's making a fire or something, cooking, and all of a sudden a bear lumbers into his camp. And he's like, oh God, what do I do? Like, the bear wasn't necessarily being aggressive, but it wouldn't leave. He did what you're supposed to. He yelled, he screamed, he banged pots and pans together. He started chucking rocks. And the bear just wouldn't leave. It would like disappear into the woods and then show up on the other side of him. He's like, this bear is creeping me out. He's obviously accustomed to people. I have a gun, but I'm not going to take the life of a bear. This is not life threatening. So he's like, screw it. I don't know where the bear is. He might be back. I'm just going to pack up and leave. So he starts packing up and he hears noise back in the woods. He knows the bear is still there. It's waiting in theory, until he goes to bed, and then he's going to steal his food, which is probably what this bear has learned to do. And he's like, nope, I'm not going to give him the opportunity. So he takes half an hour, he packs up, and he paddles away from camp. He looks back, and the bear darts into the woods. So he paddles, I think he paddled past someone's campsite and let him know about it. Nope, that's the wrong order. Sorry. He first goes to the portage. So he's like, screw it. Like, there's tons of other people on this lake. I'm going to go to the portage. I'm just going to portage back to whatever lake was next. And that way I can get away from the bear. And so he gets to the portage, and out of the woods comes the bear. It's on the portage. It followed him along the shoreline, and it sat down in the middle of the portage. It knew exactly what it was doing. It sat down in the middle of the portage, and it didn't let him leave. He just sat there 10, 15 feet from shore. He's like, you got to be kidding me. Like, this bear literally followed me to the portage and blocked my escape route. So he decided to turn around. He paddled to the other side of the lake, and he ran into this group, and he told this group this story, like, hey, I got this bear. It isn't being aggressive, but it won't leave me alone. He told them the story of it, you know, trying to get at his food and then cutting him off at the portage and literally sitting down on the portage. And the people are like, yeah, sure, you can stay with us. There's no other campsite available. And he ended up spending the night with them. And fortunately, it was far enough away, they never saw the bear again. But the bear literally followed him along the shoreline and sat down at the portage and blocked his escape route.
Is he paddling around in pitch black? I mean, he had a light, but...
I think there was still some light out. By the time he got other people's camp, it was dark. So he kind of felt weird about interrupting someone's quiet time. Yeah. But yeah, I think this was... It was right at sundown by the time he like packed up and left. So... I'm assuming he had a headlight and that's how he saw the bear on the path, but I don't know. I didn't ask him that question, but yeah, it was towards the evening, if not dark. So I thought that was wild.
That is wild. I can't imagine like being at another site and then somebody just strolling in the, I mean, it's dark out and popping up and telling us that story. I would hope that anyone out there would welcome that person to stay with them that night.
Oh yeah. Sorry, buddy. Figure it out yourself. Get out of here. Ironic thing, I've probably been on 40 or more overnight trips and probably another 60 day trips. So I'm probably pushing 100 trips in the Boundary Waters. I've never once seen a moose in the woods. I've seen them driving. Up until last year, winter camping trip, I had never seen a wolf, and I still have never seen a bear. I don't understand how I am that lucky or unlucky, depending on which animal you're looking at. But yeah, like the fact that I haven't seen, yeah, up until last year, one pack of wolves, but I haven't seen, I've seen deer, which are almost even more rare to see in the Boundary Waters. But yeah, I haven't had the privilege of seeing a moose or a bear. So I'm kind of bummed about that. Not so much about the bear, but yeah, you hear about people who go like once a year and they've seen like 10 bears in the Boundary Waters. Like, how is this happening? How do I not see this wildlife? Maybe I'm too loud. Maybe I talk too much.
Why? Short answer here, but like, why do you think that is? Because like, I feel like I come back from trips and like my dad in particular, he's always like, what wildlife do you see? And like, you don't really see like a ton of like the big game wildlife out there. Do you think it's just because they have so many places to escape your visual sight lines, or there's just not a huge amount of them?
Well, I think when it comes to wolves, they see, smell, hear you from miles away, and they want nothing to do with you. Sure. We are way too loud, and we stink too much, and we're too noisy, and we're too stinky at our campsites, and they want nothing to do with us. Bears are the opposite. If they need food, they're going to seek it out mostly. Bears are still very timid creatures, and they do not like humans. But honestly, I think it's just human impact in the usage. I think the boreal forest is full of so much food for these animals, with the exception of drought years. They don't want anything to do with humans. Moose are a different story because they feed at the water, which is not the case for bears and wolves and some of the other animals. So we get lucky because moose are huge and not really camouflaged. They make tons of noise. Their eyesight is terrible. They got good hearing and they can smell really well. But moose are a lot easier to sneak up on. So yeah, I think that's unfortunate because people hear about how wild the Boundary Waters is and then they go and they're like, Well, I only saw a couple of chickadees and some fish and some crayfish, yeah. Snapping turtle. It's like, I could have seen that down in southern Minnesota or in Illinois, where I'm from. Right. We just have to understand that we are in their world and they understand the terrain and where their food sources are. And they have no reason to go. Most of these animals have no reason to go anywhere near humans and been accustomed to know that humans are the enemy, and humans generally only mean, you know, unfortunately, pain and death when it comes to animals.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny. I read this story of this guy. He was in the Ely area and it was his first time ever there. And he was driving and he almost hit a moose, and he saw three moose, and he like pulled over and went to the nearest, to the gas station, and like asked the gas station worker, are there a ton of moose up in this area? And they were like, well, there's some, but I've never seen one. And he's like, what, really? This is my first time ever being here. And I just drove past three of them and almost hit one. But yeah. The people living there had never seen one before.
The joke we always laugh about, I'm going to call myself a local, but you know, that's a bit contentious when you live in a small community. But anyway, we locals always joke that the one question that always gets us laughing is when a tourist, a visitor will come in and ask us, where's the best place to go to see moose? And obviously the answer is the middle of a swamp in the middle of nowhere, but they mean, where do I drive? What overlook do I park at where I can watch moose, like a Yellowstone situation where the herd of buffalo is off in the distance? And we always kind of laugh about that because it is truly luck. Like, you see more when you're driving between here and Two Harbors on Highway 1 because it cuts through really thick, dense, sparsely populated human areas. Where those animals live, you're much more likely to see one driving your car slowly down a gravel road at 5 a.m. than you are on a canoe trip, banging your paddle on the gunwales or making noise. So yeah, you just kind of have to be in the right time at the right place. And I've seen probably 5 or 6 moose now, and all of them have been in Forest Service burned or clear cut areas where the young saplings are starting to grow back, the aspens that those moose like to feed on, when those aspens are really young and tender still. So yeah, it's kind of ironic that you like go to a wilderness area generally for the wilderness experience, and you're more likely to see a bear or a wolf or a moose on your drive to the entry point than you actually are in the woods.
Mm-hmm. I know, I hear you. Well, Eric, this has been great. Anything else quick we should know before we let you go?
I don't think so. I mean, we talked a lot about the Quetico, and I don't want to take anything away from the Boundary Waters. Like, both areas are unbelievable and have quite literally changed my life. So even if you're someone who's not inherently into camping, fishing, hunting, there's a lot to take away from wilderness experiences in canoe country. We didn't talk about the Northern Lights. We didn't talk about stargazing. We didn't talk about the fact that like the boreal forest is the gateway to Hudson Bay and one of the biggest migrations of bird and waterfowl of anywhere in the world. Like, there's so much to do in this area. I don't want to overshadow that with my talk of fishing and hunting. So yeah, there's something for everybody up here. The boreal forest is incredible. Living in rural areas is phenomenal. That's another one we could do an entire podcast on. Small living, community living has been rejuvenating for my wife Lacey and I to move to, you know, a small rural area and be a big fish in a small pond, so to speak. So yeah, I just can't speak highly enough about this area, my neighbors, the community. So come up here with your families, your friends, spend money at our restaurants and liquor stores and bait shops. And yeah, stop in at Paragus and say hello if you're in the area. I'll either be out fishing or I'll be working. So come say hi.
Yeah, dude, this has been great. I think this is the second full episode we've dedicated to the Boundary Waters, and I don't think we've covered even half of the things that we've talked about covering or have wanted to cover. So we'll probably have to have you on again maybe towards the fall to talk about late season. But thank you so much again. Check out Eric's YouTube channel, Farwater. Check out his website, chasingfarwater.com. Thank you, everybody, for sticking with us and listening. We hope between now and next time you get a chance to get outside and adventure. Bye, everybody.